friends, it's good to be back with you again. I'm Henrik Palmgren. We are heading into spring here in the Northern Hemisphere, and it's starting to heat up finally. I hope you're taking some time off and enjoying the outside. Spend some time with your feet on the ground or in the soil, getting in touch with the land. Very important. Well, if you enjoy listening to our program, you can get more of them on redicecreations.com. Over a year of shows available, first hour always free, sometimes both, no commercial interruptions. You can tune in whenever it suits you. You can stream or download through the website or subscribe to our podcast feed. Our entire archive, by the way, is available at redicemembers.com, and we have all programs listed by year in our RSS feeds as well, going back to 2006. So it's a quick and easy download if you use iTunes or other feed readers or a podcast app, for example, on your tablet or mobile device. We have all the instructions for that on the members website, redicemembers.com. Our guests today is Joseph Atwill and Jerry Russell. Joseph has been with us before. He is an independent scholar who has set the world of New Testament scholarship in a new direction. In his book, Caesar's Messiah, The Roman Conspiracy to Invent Jesus, Atwill outlines the series of events in Jesus' ministry that are parallels with the event of the battle campaign of Titus Flavius as recorded by Josephus Flavius in his War of the Jews. Numerous scholars had noticed the parallels between the Gospels and Josephus' work before, but Atwill is the first to notice that all the parallels take place in exact sequence and draw some revolutionary conclusions. We've spoken with him about this particular topic in previous programs that I urge you to listen to if you want to find out more about that. We've also spoken about his work on Shakespeare that also looks at typology as an underlying factor. We also have with us, joining us for the first hour, a new guest, Jerry Russell. He obtained a Master of Science in Electrical Engineering from Stanford University in 1981 and worked in the fields of signal processing, analog circuit design, and machine vision. In 1996, he finished a doctorate in cognitive psychology at the University of Oregon, where he continued to study visual information processing and Bayesian statistics. During the period from 1999 to 2001, he became increasingly astounded and dismayed by economic, political, and social events, including the dot-com crash and the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and began devoting time to researching the topic of elite criminality and conspiracy. The topic today is about the author J.D. Salinger, his book Catcher in the Rye, and not only its strange connection to all these mind-controlled assassinators, but we'll go deep and look at the underlying message behind the book, and of course read between the lines and how it has been used by those seeking to subvert culture by hijacking teenage rebelliousness and extending it into the counterculture of the 1960s. All right, thank you for joining us, gentlemen. It's great to have you here. First of all, welcome back, Mr. Atwill. It's good to talk to you again. How have you been?
I've been fine, Henrik, and it's a pleasure to be back.
Very good. We also have with us Jerry Russell joining us for the first time here. Thank you so much, Mr. Russell, for coming on. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm great. It's great to be here. Thanks for calling me up.
You bet. Thank you for joining us here. Yeah, we're going to have you with us in the first hour, and of course, you are... You're joining Joe writing on the website postflaviana.org. We can talk a little bit more about that later and make sure people know where to go. There's some great articles on that website that I've been going through in the last couple of days here. But we're going to begin to speak about your latest piece, Joe, about Catcher in the Rye. Very important work. You sent me the article and I've been going through it, and it's just so many good things in there we want to make sure that we get to here today. But maybe you can set the framework for us a little bit and talk about J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye. I actually read it many years ago, and I could never figure out what the big deal was, what is in this book. And of course, when I started reading your article, things were starting to, you know, to fall into place. But maybe we can begin to talk about typology first, because this is central to the question. You've been with us before speaking about typology. Give us a background on that quickly, if you will.
Well, typology is just literature that uses other works as a framework, so that when you read the piece in front of you, you need to have in mind the fact that it was based on or has connections to other literature. And when you have that understanding, then you get meanings that are not available just on the surface narration. And in my opinion, typology basically is the language of the oligarchs. It's what makes the Gospels and the New Testament comprehensible in the sense you get to see who actually writes them, what the real meaning is. It enables people to understand Shakespeare. And I've on other shows with you, I've talked about my interpretation of those bodies of literature and how typology gives them completely different meanings, so that you can see that basically there's a kind of a humor about genocide that's inside of them. So I was approached by an individual who had read an article I wrote called Manufacturing the Deadhead, which I wrote because I was asked another question, which was what brought about neo-Christianity? In other words, since I was talking about Christianity as mind control, someone came to me and he said, well, what is this neo-Christianity, the Christianity of Oprah and Marianne Williamson? And this all goes back to this book, A Course in Miracles. And so when I was asked to study it, I looked at this book and saw that, you know, how they were basically creating a new kind of mind control with this neo-Christianity. And then I studied the authors, Thetford and Schumann, and noticed that they were employees of this odd CIA organization called MKUltra. So this began this long journey where I started looking at the counterculture, and it ended up with this article, Manufacturing the Deadhead, which I tried to link the government activities to the production of the counterculture, and that this was done to dumb down culture, to move it to a debased condition so that the government could control the population more easily. And so when that article came out, one of the things that immediately was brought to my attention was all of this, these strange connection to Catcher in the Rye and MKUltra. This is because, you know, MKUltra produced what was turned into a movie called The Manchurian Candidate, which kind of talks about turning people into robots using signals, and then you turn them into robots. And the book Catcher in the Rye was associated with many famous assassinations. Mark David Chapman, after he purportedly killed John Lennon, actually opened up the Catcher in the Rye and was reading it when he was arrested. John Hinckley was carrying the book when he attempted to kill Reagan. And it's alleged that Lee Harvey Oswald also had a copy. They had four books in his apartment, and one of them was Catcher in the Rye. And then there's a couple other assassinations that are the assassin had the book. And so people had speculated that perhaps this was kind of a signal as the one that's portrayed in the movie, The Manchurian Candidate. And this was the question that was brought to me was, well, what is the relationship between Catcher and this MKUltra mind control? And so I read the book, and I was first amazed at what a miserable book it was, how horrible it was as drama, and also how morally destructive the book is. I was amazed that it's on all of these mandatory reading lists for high schoolers, because the central character is basically an alcoholic, chain-smoking, alienated, kind of perverted sexual, you know, angst-ridden individual. Why would this character be presented to America's teenagers?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I said, well, what's this all about? And so I tried to take a deeper look at it, and I looked at it perhaps from the perspective of typology. I was suspicious. And the first thing that really stood out to me was that in the book toward the end, Holden is talking about his experiences at the prep school that he failed, that he dropped out of. And he said that in the prep school, they had a GD secret fraternity that I was too yellow to join. I'm not going to use the obscenities when I describe Catcher, but the audience knows what I'm talking about. Is that, and Holden in general is just always making obscenities. This is one of his attributes. He curses constantly. Anyway, so Holden had belonged to a secret fraternity, And it's the identity of the secret Trinity isn't given. He Holden just makes the statement that they had this. One of the reasons he didn't like the high school purportedly is because they had a secret fraternity and he joined it. So the question is, well, what is the secret fraternity? And then I started to look at the details of the book, and I found that at the very beginning of the book, one of the things that he fails at that led him to being kicked out of the school is that he had failed a test on the Egyptians, and that his teacher said that Caulfield had studied the Egyptians for 28 days and then failed a test. And they go way out of the way to make sure, you know, it's 28 days. The sense is we studied the Egyptians from November 4th to December the 2nd. And then Caulfield wrote an essay in which he says, I don't really know anything about the Egyptians. So he failed. Now, I tried to understand this. Like, well, what is this? And it turns out that 28 days is the amount of time that a Freemason has between when he joins and when he takes the exam to become a second degree Mason. In other words, he initiates as an apprentice, entered apprentice, and then goes on to become a second degree Mason by taking this exam. Now, Salinger is simply using the concept of the Egyptians as a typology to represent the Freemasons, because the Freemasonry claim lineage directly from the ancient Egyptians, and they use their symbols and their rites. So this really isn't, you know, from that perspective, too hard to understand that Salinger is making kind of a, at this point, there's no way to know exactly what his point is, but that it's kind of a cryptic indication as to what is the secret society that Caulfield joined, right? I mean, it's 28 days studying the Egyptians. He takes the exam and he fails. So then with that understanding, I started to go through the book and I realized that the entire book is basically a cryptic representation of Caulfield going through the levels of Freemasonry. And I won't go through all of them, but I would encourage anyone who's interested in the analysis to simply go to postflaviana.org and the article's there. And it's a free website. And incidentally, we take questions. Jerry's available. I'm available. We take all questions, try to make sure that there is no confusion, because it's a very important, very serious subject, because I think you'll see when we go further how significant the analysis is and actually what the book Ketra and Rai does and what it's supposed to operate as in our culture. It's important to know. Anyway, going through it then, I saw things like Caulfield talks about how he's sleeping in Eli's bed. And when I read the book, I noticed that Salinger used the expression lying there in Eli's bed, laying down in Eli's bed. I was lying in Eli's bed. Repeating the concept of lying down in Eli's bed. And in cryptic writing, in typology, one of the things that you use is you repeat the concept to bring it to the mind of the alert reader that this has a particular significance. And so then when you look at Freemasonry, the answer is obvious. This is the introduction to the prophetical office. It's one of the rites of Freemasonry in which you pass through as you work your way up the ladder, and it's based on the story in the Old Testament of the Samuel who goes to the Lord before Eli and then is made to lie down in Eli's bed. So this is cryptic, but only barely cryptic, because I think at the time that Salinger wrote Ketra and the Rai, not many people were familiar with the rites of Freemasonry, but now there's been so many people that have put information out into the internet that, you know, that Salinger's veil is fairly easy to lift. And when you understand Eli's bed as just a kind of a comical way of talking about the rite of the prophetical office in Freemasonry, it makes perfect sense. And then you actually have, you reenact the death of Hiram Abiff, which is, you know, one of the levels of Freemasonry attest. And that one's a little long, but basically he he simply goes through the business of being blindfolded and trying to get the hand of someone and then falling over backwards after getting hit in the head. I mean, it's when you look at, and I ask and encourage people to go through the article and see, when you look at these things in the sequence and order that Salinger's going through them and, you know, how compressed they all are, it becomes really obvious the identity of the secret fraternity. I mean, these things could not be accidental, you know, that because they align so logically and obviously into Freemasons' symbolism. And now you've got sort of the nature of the of what Caulfield is doing as he works through these weird events in the books. He's just going through Salinger is just cryptically representing his passing through the different levels of Freemasonry. And anyway, then what gets the part that is troubling, of course, is that he eventually gets to part where he's able to enter into the Holy of Holies, and this is represented as the museum in which the Egyptians are, you know, going back to the first passage where he fails the test on the Egyptians. Here he's going to actually get to go and be in the presence of the Egyptians because they have mummies there. And he keeps seeing the word as he comes up to this place, which is representing the Holy of Holies in the Freemason temple. He sees the two words FU, and I won't give the obscenity, but all of your listeners would know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that when two brothers meet Holden Caulfield to take him into this place, which are representing the Freemason brothers, you know, and so then they take him in and they disappear. So he must go in by himself, you know. Salinger sets this up, and he gets there and he sees the two words again. He sees FU written on the wall, and now in this context, this is sick and troubling, because really what he's talking about here is at this higher level a design to genocide or to do ill to everyone who is a non-Mason, basically everyone who is not inside of the group that is producing this stuff. And just to you know, to go on with it, Caulfield says it'll be the FU will be on his gravestone. Right. So in other words, this basically is representing the fact that the oath is taken to death. And he goes on and says that, and he's talking now to the general public. He says, you can't ever find a place that's nice and peaceful because there isn't any. You may think there is, but once you get there, when you're not looking, and I'm going to notice the secrecy, right? Notice that when you get there, when you're not looking, someone will sneak up and write F you right under your nose. This is very troubling because he seems to be suggesting that there is a deliberate design, which, as you look at Salinger's life and his background in military intelligence, would be right inside our government, I would presume. And so this is sort of like the question of what is the identity of the secret fraternity. Now we have to ask ourselves, what is the identity of, or what is the plan that is being described by the FU.
Right.
And when you read the article, you'll see I'll go into that. And basically, Caulfield is at the end of the book, he's sort of representing the apocalypse with the four horses. And earlier in the book, Caulfield talks about a red hat, which is his shooting hat, he says. And his roommate says, well, you know, we have hats like that where I come from. And Caulfield says, no, this is a special hat. This is a hat to shoot people with. I wear this hat when I shoot people. And he makes the one eye symbol, right? The one eye of Freemasonry representing the eye of all-seeing eye of God. Mm-hmm. And Salinger says, you know, I make the one that Caulfield, you know, closes an eye and uses it, looks through the one eye like he's shooting someone. And in the context of Freemasonry, all of these symbols suddenly make sense. I mean, one of the ways, you know, Henrik, that you know you're onto the right interpretive framework is when all the incoherency of the book starts to drop away and suddenly just make perfect sense. No one really understands Catcher in the Rye. The book is just completely incoherent. I mean, it has like a passage about someone called Albert Pike, which describes him as very conceited. And this is just this bizarre segue. It makes no sense. What is he talking about? But remember, Albert Pike is a famous, perhaps the most famous American Freemason.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And so then when you look at the passage as well, he's really talking about Pike's Freemason perspective of how he was very conceited. He talked about how only certain levels will have any understanding. I mean, then suddenly all of these incoherencies to the book drop away. And then finally, the conclusion of the book, Caulfield talks about, you know, he's been in a mental asylum, you know, wholesome, you know, kind of a role model, right? He's been in a mental asylum. And he talks about three individuals that, and I'm not going to go into the analysis because, but it takes a while, but he's already described the fact that he intends to kill them. And he concludes the book by saying, you know, even old Strat, Ladder, and Ackley, I'm even going to miss that old Maurice. And he goes, it's funny. Don't ever tell anybody anything. If you do, you'll start missing everybody. Right. Mm. So that he says, about all I know is I sort of miss everybody I told about. And he says, don't ever tell anybody anything. Otherwise, you'll start missing everybody. Well, that's why the book has been associated with assassinations. It's not that it's a mind control trigger. It's because to the Freemasons who understand the symbolism, it has this meaning of do not talk about the organization. And I think the reason that Lenin was assassinated is that in his Playboy interview, he talks about not wanting to be a craftsman and how the Beatles being brought to the United States was craftsmanship. He talks about LSD being created by the CIA. And I think that he essentially crossed a line. And so that the assassin then had the book just as to remind people to be quiet. And I'll just segue to another
author. It was placed as a marker on him. Doesn't exactly. Okay. Just want to clarify
exactly.
That. It doesn't.
That's what it is. Yeah. It's not a mind control thing for the assassin. They just bring the book in to remind people, keep your mouth shut.
Yeah.
Now, another book, and I'm not going to, go into it, but it can be decoded and I do understand it and I will be producing analysis. But another one is Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer. Twain is a well-known Freemason. Salinger really wasn't known as a Freemason, but Twain is a huge Freemason. And at the end of Tom Sawyer, you have this is actually the concluding lines. He goes, they're talking. He goes, when are we going to start the gang and turn robbers? Oh, right off. We'll get the boys together and have the initiation tonight. Have the witch, have the initiation. What's that? It's to swear to stand by one another and never tell the gang's secrets, even if you're chopped all to flinders, and kill anybody and all his family that hurts one of the gang. Now, Twain includes this charming little homage to the secrecy of Freemason at the conclusion of his book, and Salinger is just typologically representing this with his. He's just saying, when he says, don't ever tell anybody anything, and Twain says, swear the oath taking to stand by one another and never tell the gang secret, this is just, their typologic representation of the secrecy that has to be maintained. Because frankly, genocide always needs a cover story, doesn't it, Henry?
Yeah, exactly. It always does. So just to kind of, it's a subtextual story where you obviously have to read between the lines, make certain connections to understand why the storyline goes in the direction as it does. But because I've always thought kind of similar thing does happen when you read Shakespeare. I think if you just take things at face value, it doesn't quite make sense, does it? It's not until you really piece it together. Otherwise, it's just poor literature, isn't it?
It's just completely incoherent. I mean, the idea of people trying to explain the bloodbath in Titus Andronicus or Romeo and Juliet or Hamlet, why all the violence, is this just, drama? There needs to be some sort of symbolic framework for this stuff, and there just isn't any unless you understand that Shakespeare is making fun of the typology in the Gospels, and then suddenly the stories make perfect sense. And then, you know, like the just taking Romeo and Juliet, then, you know, the dating system of leading up to the Feast of L'Amistad, the 42 hours that Juliet is, you know, is asleep, and the 7 days that the play will span. I mean, all of these things suddenly become understandable in the context of someone just mocking the Gospels and the fake Daniel timeline and prophecies inside of that. So, I hope that that people will look at the analysis, add to it, ask questions about it, and bring the questioning into the public vernacular. I think a lot of people can participate in this. They can ask questions. The media should pick this up as a story, that there is a pretty easy to understand subtext to Catcher in the Rye, that with some help, and I think hopefully our analysis in the article will do this. People can understand. The average person can just understand that this was the book was written for the purpose really of representing this secret level of Freemasonry. And so once this becomes part of our public vernacular, for one thing, the book will stop hurting the public, because right now I think it's very damaging. I think it's, you know, forces inside the government make sure that it's on all the mandatory reading lists. But the book is very destructive. If you look at the character, he has no, there's nothing really, beneficial about him. He's just a mentally ill individual with every bad habit that a teenager could ever have. So why is he given as some kind of role model? They talk about the book being, you know, this, it's sort of the Bible of teenage onks. Well, that is nonsense. This is a book to create teenage onks. This is a book to break down young people. So the book is really destructive. There's a lot of things inside the media that are very destructive and are designed to break down, you know, our abilities to think clearly and to feel good and to basically to participate in our government. And so we need to identify them, and people need to think about them and learn ways to fight back.
So it's multiple layers here. It kind of fulfills the larger story to those who are in the know, and then it kind of helps to aid to create the teenage deadhead rebel rousers and everything else, right?
So yeah, that's right.
It's very interesting. And by the way, I know you edited the article, Jerry, as well. So feel free to join in if there's something we're missing.
Well, yeah, I had the experience of having a different take on it. Now, in the case of Shakespeare, I've obviously read Shakespeare before, and I like Shakespeare. You know, Joe doesn't. I do. I enjoy Shakespeare, and I find that a lot of the plots are meaningful on the surface level. And although I read the Catcher in the Rye after I'd read the first draft of Joe's essay, I had a different take on that as well. I like Catcher in the Rye, and maybe I had more teenage onks than Joe did, but I could relate to it. A lot of the mistakes that Holden made, I didn't make, and a few of them that he made, I made in my life. But I felt like he was kind of a friendly character who had a lot of problems. And the thing that leaped out to me about the book, in addition to everything that Joe said, was that Holden really, really wanted to quit being a Freemason. He didn't respect the group. He didn't respect their egotism. He didn't want to study. He didn't care for all those classes that he was supposed to take about the Egyptians. He really only had one piece of curiosity about the Egyptians, which was about the mummification. How did they preserve themselves for so long? He was curious about that. And the reason that he finally decided to stay with the Freemason program and to kind of give up his desire to go to Colorado and become a rancher is because of his sister Phoebe. His sister Phoebe just is concerned that his dad's going to kill him, that the Freemasons might kill him. She cares for him. She begs him to come home and to rejoin the program, and eventually that's why he decides to do it. And, you know, it wasn't completely obvious to me whether this threat, this FU threat against Holden, whether it's really targeted to the whole world, whether it's really a threat of genocide against everybody, or whether it's just specifically directed at Holden Caulfield, saying, hey, you're in this fraternity, you've gone part of the way in our program with us, you know a lot of secrets, you need to join up or you are effed. So he decides to join the program, and it's really hard to tell what happens in the ending scene, whether, you know, Holden puts on his red shooting cap and the smoke gets in your eyes, music plays, and is this just something that's going on in his imagination, that he's seeing the kids falling off of the they're kids on a merry-go-round. And they're grabbing for the brass ring, and he imagines that the kids are grabbing for the brass ring and some of them are going to fall off. And that's really sad, but he's realized that there's nothing you can do to help those kids who are going to fall off. But really, is he shooting them, and is there real smoke going on, and has he gone bonkers? Is this a mass murder incident that he's glossing over? Or is he just enjoying watching the kids on the merry-go-round? And we aren't sure. And he's sent off to some sort of rehabilitation center on the West Coast. And what sort of rehabilitation is going on here exactly? Is he being force-fed LSD? We just don't know. The book leaves a lot of questions open. And the ambiguity of it is something I really appreciated. And so I thought it was fun in that regards.
Right. I just wanted to mention that in the analysis that people can read, I think the ambiguity that Jerry refers to is cleared up by the actual title of the book, which is called Catcher in the Rye. And the ambiguity is correct. In other words, yeah, on one hand, Holden might be this beneficial guy who has these problems with being in the secret fraternity because of all of the violence and damage that he sees that it's doing. But the catcher in the rye is a misunderstanding of the actual song that Robert Burns wrote. And this actually gives the very clear explanation as to what's going on at the end of the book. And let me explain this. Holden Caulfield thinks he hears a child singing a song which has the line "Catcher in the Rye." He says that. Then he goes to his sister Phoebe and he says, "You know, I want to do that when I get older. I want to be someone who goes and catches the children when they fall." He had talks about this dream that he has, and he's catching the children, saving them. But this isn't the correct understanding of the song. And his sister Phoebe points out that he's misunderstood it. Now, the question becomes, well, because there's two versions of Robert Burns' poem. One of them describes the individual who goes through the wheat field and uses the F word. So you have the actual meaning would be the effer in the rye, right? So this is the question that is put before Holden Caulfield is, which way do you go? Are you going to be a catcher in the rye and catch the children? Or are you going to be, as Robert Burns wrote, the effer in the rye? Right. Mm. So now when Caulfield comes to that, to the final scene, he says, you know, I've learned that when children are going to fall, you just let them fall. And so now it's clear that he isn't going to be beneficial. He's made his decision. But so Jerry and I disagree about that. And I think that,
I agree that he's made his decision that he's not going to be beneficial.
Right. And I agree that Jerry, you know, I agree that you know, there is this kind of question that's put out there. But what I'm trying to say is, what I'm hoping is that people will go to the analysis and just look at what is done in terms of the representation of the Freemasonry and of the potential that this is a, you know, has a top level that has a violent plan. Because as you can see from the analysis I put out, that this is, you know, a very logical way to understand it. And that this will begin the discussion. Because I am positive that if the catcher in the rye starts to be discussed on its symbolic level, on the level of the Freemason initiation, that this will lead to an understanding of what is the FU. Because, you know, Henrik, you can see that, you know, Jerry's brought out a, you know, another way of understanding it. I disagree with this. I think it's very clear. But what I really want is for the question to be asked and the analysis to be done. Because I think when you put this in the context of what Salinger was part of, and this is, you know, basically the MK Ultra operation against teenagers that began after World War II, then I think, you know, what the FU is becomes self-evident. I don't think, you know, there really is much of a question. And I think that interpretations that somehow Salinger was talking about something outside of this enormous project that military intelligence was involved with. And remember, Salinger was in military intelligence. That's where he came from, World War II. It's very clear, which of the two ways of understanding the FU will I think the public will understand. The public,
well, you can understand it in both ways, Joe.
They can. But Jerry, I just want to make sure they understand it in the way that they need to worry about it being a deliberate design to damage people in our society. They can understand it in other ways, but they need to understand that much, that this is very possibly, very likely a description of a deliberate design to genocide sections of our population. And once that idea is in the public vernacular, then I'm willing to, you know, whatever the analysis the public wants to do, they can do. But they deserve to have that question brought to them. Is what is the FU that Holden Caulfield is describing?
Now, well, let's talk more about what that really is later, but as a way maybe to bridging some of this, I would say I think it's always a real component that is part of these kinds of works that are going to resonate with a lot of people, and they have to. They should. I mean, it's like, I think, again, me reading it as a teenager, I remember it was kind of strange to me, the book. I didn't really get some of the things, but at the same time, the angst, the frustration, the problematic relationship kind of to the rest of the world, that's evident. And I think most teenagers will connect with that for many different reasons. I think the bigger maybe question we should ask here is that, you know, the book was released in 1951, but I think around 250,000 copies are sold each year, with a sale of more than 65 million books. It's, as you said, Joe, it's ended up on, you know, one of those, everyone has to read it. I think Times 2005 list, it ended up on the 100 best English language novels written since 1923.
It's just incredible, I know.
Yeah, in 2003, it was listed at number 15 on the BBC survey of the biggest read. Modern Library and its readers said it was one of the 100 best English language novels of the 20th century. So the question is, how did it end up there and who put it there? And a follow-on to that is, when these books are written in this way, is it just that, okay, he wrote the story, it was done in this way, but those who are in the know make sure that it gets promoted in the right way because it contains what it need to contain to do the job? Or is this go ahead and write it in this kind of way? Is that what they ordered Salinger to do? What's your take on that, Joe?
Well, the best way to understand that, unfortunately, will involve a little bit of work on your listener's part, but I hope everyone does this, is on the internet, you can go and look at the 1957 Life magazine cover, and that cover describes the trip that Gordon Wasson made supposedly to Mexico to discover the magic mushroom. And this really is the beginning of the drug culture, the psychedelic drug culture. And it starts in 1957, May 1957, with this article. I have a, you know, some descriptions of the article and what it means in the article I wrote, Manufacturing the Deadhead. But the fact is that Gordon Wasson's trip was paid for by MKUltra. Gordon Wasson was working for MKUltra for what's called Subproject 58. And that the story that was presented in Life magazine is a lie. And then again, I can show this beyond a shadow of doubt. I mean, he went there, but the characterization that he's making of looking and searching and having these spiritual aspects, this is all just set up to help begin the process of making the drugs acceptable to the teenagers later on. So you can see how long-standing the projects are. But anyway, what I wanted to refer to, and I know this is long-winded, but it's important, is on the cover of Life magazine, you have a few words which describe the trip that Wasson makes to Mexico, strange visions in the Mexican desert. And directly underneath that, those words, there are the words of purportedly of another article, but it's described as teenage allowances. And I maintain that once you recognize that the first description of the beginning of the psychedelic drug culture is something that MKUltra is producing, and I actually show the pay requisitions for Wasson's trip from the CIA in the article. It's completely clear that the next statement, teenage allowances, is auto-suggestion. There is absolutely no chance that phrase would be directly underneath the introduction to the what becomes the drug culture in the 60s for the baby boomers. And what you're looking at is auto-suggestion. Now, this is clear because MKUltra was studying this, and so the first phrase that describes the trip to Mexico is in fact part of the second phrase, so that teenage allowances is being placed into the minds of people. It's auto-suggestion that the strange visions with drugs are going to be something that teenagers are going to be allowed to do. And the reason, okay, I've been long-winded about this is because this is the context for Catcher in the Rye. This is the context that the book needs to be weighed in and understood in, is that there was a an operation that comes through military intelligence after World War II that had the idea of creating a population that was debased and easy to control, basically drug-addled, among other things. And so when you look at Salinger's book as the kind of beginning or part of this process, you can see that it fits perfectly, that it is kind of a transition. I mean, Holden Caulfield is an alcoholic. He's a chain smoker. He's sort of sexually degenerate, or at least,
he looks for a prostitute or something,
right,
like that.
Right, he has a prostitute. You know, so he has, so this is the, you know, he fits into this whole pattern that leads up to then Gordon Wasson, the acceptance of drugs as a spiritual quest, sex, drugs, and rock and roll as freedom, mm-hmm. rebellion. And so, you know, the teenage angst that Holden Caulfield, you know, experiences and promotes is then resolved, you know, in the youth culture with sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So in that context, you know, the book that Salinger wrote can be understood as a weapon. And then I would just finally mention the third point I wanted to cover, which is that there's a very good book called Weaponized Anthropology, which describes the activity of Gregory Bateson, and anyone can go online and see the most important parts of it. And And in one of them, Bateson talks about, in a letter that was obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, that experiments were done which showed how a superior population could control an inferior population. And those aren't my words. I'm not paraphrasing Bateson. This is his sentence. He wrote that the most significant experiment which has yet been conducted in the adjustment of relations between superior and inferior peoples is the Russian handling of their Asiatic tribes in Siberia. And he goes on to say that really what you want to do if you want to basically take the stress and tension out of enslaving a group is you promote in them a native revival. You take them backwards and make them embrace their past. So in other words, this group was told to put on dance festivals and exhibits of their primitive culture, and they were given praise for doing so. Now, Bateson, who created this science, was called on this by David Price, who's an anthropologist, and he said, you know, basically Bateson was weaponizing anthropology. Well, bear in mind that Bateson then goes on, and he is the individual who creates the CIA. When Donovan went to Truman to try to get funding for the OSS after World War II, Truman said no. Donovan brings in Bateson's rationale for the CIA, which basically is that because with nuclear weapons, we can't fight that kind of war much longer. We need to have mental ways of controlling populations. So that was Bateson's basically saying that, you know, we need to control the inferior people. Where does Bateson go? He ends up in the Palo Alto VA with Robert Hunter, who's the lyricist of the Grateful Dead, Ken Kesey. And then suddenly you have the promotion of LSD by rock and roll groups that are all dressed up like American Indians and cowboys, right? Native revival. You see what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So when you see the trajectory and you put Catcher in the Rye in context, I won't dispute that people can have a good experience with the book. I know lots of people who've enjoyed it. I know people enjoy Shakespeare. What I see in the book is an incoherent piece of drama that's morally destructive, and has all of these sort of hard to understand little vignettes in it that really, as the surface narration goes on, doesn't make much sense. But when you place it in the context that I'm suggesting, the book makes perfect sense. It's a weapon. It's meant to damage culture. It's meant to make teenagers susceptible to all of the things that will then be given to them. In terms of the native revival, our archaic revival, as Terence McKenna called it in his book, he was obviously working in the same, you know, context.
There's another way you can look at that whole question of where did this book come from and what was Solinger doing with it, and that's just to look at Solinger himself and his background. And I'm not an expert on this, and my knowledge that I'm going to impart to you here comes from the Wikipedia article. But it's pretty interesting that Solinger was from a relatively middle-class Jewish background, and he went to private school at Valley Forge Military Academy, and he had a lot of trouble there. He was a mediocre student. He seemed to be floundering, and he finally decided that he wanted to be a writer, and he enrolled at Columbia University School of General Studies in an evening class. And he took a course from Whit Burnett, who was the editor of Story magazine there, and continued to have some trouble for a while, but suddenly he caught fire. And he was able to get three stories published in the Story magazine there, and Burnett started to be his mentor. And so I might be curious to look at Burnett and learn more about that. Following that, he started dating Ona O'Neill, the daughter of Eugene O'Neill. So he's getting some more literary tutelage that way. He started submitting stories to the New Yorker, and he started a friendship with more famous authors. And finally, He became assigned to the counterintelligence division in World War II. And after that, he became this famous author. So he went through a path.
Well, I mean, the whole the Frankfurt School, of course, took refuge at Columbia University, spent many years there. Critical theory came out of that. I mean, it's certainly easy to see that there is a whole kind of network, a grouping, if you will, of certain people. And again, I don't necessarily at every turn have to imply that everyone is in on it 100%, but it could be, as I said before, also about these issues when you know, they tutor people, they fund a lot of different you know aspects. But if one of them takes off, if one of them is there and poses a good example, that's when they can utilize it. That's when they can use it. I guess more work would have to be done to kind of discover a little bit more about Salinger's background, what his motives was for writing the book, and if he was kind of nudged in any way along the way. But I think, Joe, that you make a good point here, that it's been what's important to remember here is that at some point it was marketed to the teenagers that it was cool to be destructive. The role models were hijacked in a different way. You're supposed to feel, you know, depressed, and just look at the whole goth movement, for example. I mean, it's horrible that term was hijacked like that. By the way, the goths are, of course, another very proud Germanic people. But it's about harnessing and utilizing and channeling the rebellious spirit of the teenager. And this spirit is, of course, it is natural. I think it is a kind of an initiatory process to a certain extent to kind of see where the boundaries of society lie before you go into adulthood as a way of, you know, adapting yourself to the circumstances within society. But I think it's clear, I don't know if you would agree with that, Joe, but that they've utilized that and turned that against everybody as a kind of weaponized process in itself, which has been tremendously destructive. I mean, just look at where we are today. It has its inception at some point, and it began to be turned around, right?
Of course. Salinger has created a character that is to culture destructive. His drinking problem. He's throughout the entire book. He's you know, drunk. He's mentally ill, and he you know, is, it just has all of these negative characteristics. Sort of the question as to, you know, the deliberate design aspect is answered by, you know, here you have a book that has this hidden level of it, of the Freemason initiation, and I think Jerry and I can agree on that this is buried in the book. And so the idea that such a book with the secret inside it would produce someone that was destructive to culture by accident just seems to me, you know, very, very far-fetched. I think that, you know, when Holden accepts the FU as the deep secret, basically that's Salinger accepting his role in it. And his first job is to produce literature that helps break down culture. So, you know, I mean, these are, to me, the facts. And this is really what I hope comes out of the analysis, is that people will start to question whether or not this book and other books, because this isn't the only book, Henrik.
Of course, exactly.
You know, you talked about this book's place in the top 100. Well, you know, with respect to every single one of those top 100 books, you got to start asking questions about where did that book come from? What does it mean?
Yeah.
And why is it being promoted?
Exactly. Well, look at it this way too. All of this, let's take the Beatles, for example, another example of this. It doesn't mean that you can't enjoy the music out of what Beatles produced. But there is certainly a lot of interesting aspect of how this has been used against people. Again, what happened along the way, how they were nudged, etc. It's a two-pronged approach that you have to have. You understand it's yours, part of, you know, a culture. They were there. They did what they did. But if it's been used in some way, if it's been weaponized, as you said, Joe, then of course that is an aspect that we have to recognize and think about and go deeper into. And again, it doesn't mean that you can't enjoy Beatles songs, but it means that if it's something more to it than that, you might want to know about that before you just kind of, you know, uncritically just go about, you know, singing along without knowing what the lyrics means, right?
Right. Well, actually, let me go to a point of extreme crankism. I disagree. I don't think you should enjoy Beatles songs.
Yeah. Well, I know you wrote the Walrus.
Are simply too obviously a component in this whole process. I mean, you start out with "I Want to Hold Your Hand," and then you end up with "Why Don't We Do It in the Road?" You know, you start out with the Mop Tops, and then you end up with drug-addled kind of long-haired people and Sergeant Peppers singing "Lucy in the Sky with Diamond." The problem is that the oligarchs have weaponized anthropology. They have studied us. They know how we operate. And so in order to create the ability to deliver a blow, they know that you have to, the individual who is being struck has to have trust. You see, that's how propaganda
sure.
works.
Yeah.
If you suspect that, it's... coming from an enemy, the propaganda doesn't work. So the Beatles have this phase in which everyone loves them and the music is so adorable, but this is wrong. This is taking you in a bad direction because you're giving trust to some group that ultimately will deliver a destructive blow. I'll give you another example. Ken Kesey, he had a bus that, called Further, and it was painted with all these beautiful Day-Glow paints. Right. It had all these lovely colors. And then he goes around and he gives million tabs of LSD to children, where somehow he came across all this. Who knows? but the question is, well, what if he had painted on his bus a picture of an asylum and someone having a psychotic episode after taking LSD? You see, how easy would it have been for him to, give out the drugs under that context? So you just, have to look at the trust that you give people and the reasons that you give the trust to them. The reason that the Kesey and the Merry Pranksters are so infectious to teenagers is because it looked like so much fun. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. What can be wrong with this? This is a great path. Okay, well, before you walk down that path, before you take a step, the first question you should ask is, do they have an agenda for me? What is the agenda? What was in back of the Beatles? Why are so many Freemasons on the cover of Sgt. Pepper? Why is Aleister Crowley, on the cover of Sgt. Pepper? Mm-hmm. Is there an agenda? People simply need to be more critical of the elements that make up their, their minds, this media, these cultural elements. They have to be... questioning if there's an agenda in back of them before they take the first step. So, I hate to be the one guy on the planet that wants to point this out, but no, you shouldn't like the Beatles songs.
Well,
don't listen to them.
Let me put it this way, I end up agreeing with you anyway. But okay, listen, hear me out here. It's more like the more I started to look at the Beatles and understood what their part of the transformation of our culture was. Automatically, I started to dislike them. I guess what I'm saying is that people are so swayed by the music today that we don't have to start out by saying you must dislike the Beatles or else, then we'll simply turn on you. Again, considering how much they are, so popular. I think when we start understanding the role and start analyzing what their part is, I think automatically people's understanding will make their tongues. Stomach turn to a certain extent, and they will say, "Oh my God, I can't believe I was swayed by this." That's what happened with me, anyway. So I guess it's more of a tactical approach.
The Beatles, the early stuff.
Yeah.
Joe, there's something going on here, which is that there's kind of an idea of a golden age that you have of a period when culture was good, that is being overcome by the Beatles and Holden Caulfield and so forth, and that culture that you're sort of praising with a subtext here is actually, I think, Augustinian, a militaristic, kind of culture that's very purposeful And yet the purpose was not necessarily in the final analysis something that we would applaud either.
No, I'm not, you know, I won't defend 50s culture, but I will point out that, you know, there was statistical difference between, you know, drug use and single mothers. I mean, in other words, if you look at, you know, where you are in 1980, 2000 versus where you are in 1950, the counterculture has had, in my opinion, an obvious and destructive to the family, to the family and to population.
Yeah.
Because I think that really, you know, it's not to defend 50s culture. It's to make clear the motives of the people that brought the counterculture, right? What were their motives? And I think that the right answer is genocide. What they were looking at in the long run was basically the extermination of these people. That's really what is in back of that. So, okay, the 50s culture, you know, which I experienced, you know, had some problems, but that doesn't mean that the people that bring us the counterculture are somehow, you know, lacking a sinister motive.
Isn't that just kind of a... we're just kind of further down the road of manipulation and I mean, we can look at the 50s to a certain extent as kind of post World War II constructions. But if we, I think the further back we go, not necessarily that everything was great in the past. I'm not trying to imply that either. But when it comes to the adaptation of human nature and the normal relationships, I guess, between men and women, when things weren't so much manipulated on those psychological levels, I think it's better the further back we go. Sure, we've gotten material wealth and, you know, comfort to a certain extent, but it's more about, we can't just zoom in on a small portion of history and say it was good 5 years before this occurred, right? It's a longer picture that we have to view on, a bigger picture, right?
Well, I wonder if it goes in cycles, you know, that the same oligarchs that promote destruction of a culture right now could promote growth and power in a culture in a different circumstance. And I sometimes wonder if maybe Russia is being promoted currently as the culture that's being built up while ours is being torn down. I don't really know.
Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's a very good point. Yeah. I'm just thinking that I agree with Jerry that these are, you know, the questions. And I just want the citizen to... become sick of it and look at the, you know, the span of the last 100 years and just say, you know, there is something wrong. You know, World War One, World War Two, the Vietnam War, the counterculture, there's something wrong.
Yeah.
Something is sick. The destruction of the family, if you look at the population demographics in the United States and in Europe, I mean, you know, there is a kind of slow motion genocide that is taking place. So it seems to me that the citizen needs to think about that. And that would be the context that I would like the analysis I put out about Catcher in the Rye to be understood in, is that, you know, I don't have all of the answers about these things. I do, you know, no one does, in my opinion, except those that are at the helm. But we have to start thinking about them. We have to start doing our own analysis. We start unifying against the mainstream media that simply dominates our minds and puts all our ideas in us. And we want to create areas that have the ability for the citizen to get their own information. I mean, if you look at how powerful the internet is, you can see that there is some real hope and that we have to take advantage and quickly of the power that the internet gives us. When the Kennedy assassination occurred, frankly, the citizen was helpless. There was no way that people could organize themselves to try to understand the event in any way that was different than was being given to them by the mainstream media. That was it. But now there's the internet. I think that the power of the internet is growing, and I would even go so far as to say that if the events of September 11th, 2001 occurred today, that it would be much more difficult for false information to be given to the public, because there are just so many people that are wary about it. There's so much organization. I was at a party the other day, middle class, nothing special, wasn't a group of fellow paranoids, just regular guys and girls, and they were talking about 911, and it was amazing to me that no one believed it. They were all wondering and questioning, and they had confusion, and they were what the heck's going on?
Yeah.
So this is now the time when the citizen has the chance to develop their own understanding of events. And sure, the internet has many misunderstandings, misstatements of facts. There's all kinds of things that are wrong, but at least these are our errors. Of course, there are, the oligarchs are in there trying to control it, but we can fight back, and we have a chance to actually create some understanding of our world that belongs to us, not just given to us as conditioning.
Yeah, very good. I want to talk more about that in the second hour here, Joe. As you and me continue, we're gonna leave Jerry for now. I know we have some other commitments, Jerry, but let's talk about the new website you guys have. And Jerry, by the way, you've written a couple of good articles too. Maybe we can have you back in the future and talk a little bit more about those. There was some good ones on. Let me see if I can pull those up here. Well, it was the Paleolithic hunter gatherer egalitarianism. Very interesting. Jerusalem, the ultimate white man's burden. You've also written on fusion quite a bit, so there's some stuff there to dig into. Do you want to tell us about the website a bit, Jerry?
Well, sure. It's we got started. A friend of mine by the name of Rick Stanley. We met on the internet in 2002 when we were trying to make sense out of 2001, and we started talking about history and realizing that we had a huge project in front of us to kind of look at how the oligarchs had controlled the people over the entire course of history, starting with the invention of agriculture and moving forward from there. And we came to believe, and it's still a hypothesis that I don't know if it's true or if we can claim to have proven it or not, but we started to wonder if there had been one tribe or one small set of tribes that had sort of taken control in early Egypt and maintained control ever since. And kind of the Indo-European languages, the Abrahamic religions, including not only Christianity, but Judaism and Islam. And we started to wonder if all of that was just one thing that was being controlled by the oligarchs that was being used to create all of these false dialectics, all of these conflicts between the people to keep us in control. And at some point, we realized that Christianity was a key part of the scam, that it was really at the root of our American system and the Roman system that went before it. And that's when Rick and I hooked up with Joe, as a key part of our argument. And we envisioned post-Flaviana as kind of a place to develop that set of ideas. And it turns out Joe has some different ideas about what the elite exactly is and what they're trying to do and how they operate. And we're trying to discover and work through that together. But we have big plans for post-Flaviana to cover history and everything. and
very
the
good.
Truth is, yeah. We were kind of floundering before we got together with Joe. Joe insisted that we needed to get something out. And so Joe's played a key role in causing post-Flaviana to exist.
But it, right.
The articles that are out there right now, Rick is just finishing one up about 9/11, in which he's showing that the planners seem to have, to some degree, keyed the specifics of the activities off of astronomy and off of the positions of the planets and the constellations on 9/11. And we've got a preliminary version of that article up there now, and there will be a new one up shortly. And we've got articles talking about Judaism and its role with respect to Christianity as sort of a scapegoat and an underling religion of the underdogs. We've got some articles there that talk about cold fusion, and I'm particularly excited about that. This was something that I came across while I was studying about the collapse of the World Trade Towers. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that you don't really need the World Trade Towers to prove that cold fusion exists. There are some very impressive scientists who've written some wonderful papers, and there are some patent applications out there. And the way cold fusion works, I believe, is really fairly well understood. And I would love to see a people's project to sort of reverse engineer that and come up with our own version of that technology. So those are some of the things that are on the Postflaviana website, and we have a community that's getting started on the forum that's very lively. I invite any of your listeners to take a look at that.
I will mention one thing. I wrote an article trying to decode the song "I Am the Walrus."
I wanted to talk about that later, Joe, but yeah, go ahead.
but anyway, I was just going to mention that would be those that have this idea that the Beatles are this, you know, kind of just wholesome and beneficial group that, you know, had all of these positive things for culture, might want to read that analysis, and then they could see, you know, my opinion on all that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, a lot of the articles here are on postflaviana.org. We'll have that linked up here and check out some of the work that Jerry Russell has done there. But Joe, before we end, tell us about your website as well here, and give us some of the book titles and the videos you have available.
Sure. On caesarsmessiah.com, you can buy my book on Christian origin, sort of a new way of interpreting the Gospels. I also have a book on Shakespeare called Shakespeare's Secret Messiah, with a preface by Jerry. That talks about a different interpretive framework for Shakespeare. And there's also documentaries about Caesar's Messiah that are available there. I take questions about gospel criticism, origins of Christianity, anything like that. And then on postflaviana.org, and notice that the term postflaviana is relating to the Flavians and the origin of Christianity. So we're trying to create an area where the events of history following the, you know, Christian introduction can be discussed. And so in Postflaviana, we kind of focus more on the modern stuff, though we do take questions on Christianity and on the Gospels there as well.
Right, caesarsmessiah.com. We'll have that linked up as well. All right, Joe, stay with us. We'll continue with the second hour. I have much more to ask you about, but we'll also say thanks to Jerry then for joining us this time. We'll stay in touch, and we'll get you back on the show on time, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Jerry.
We proceed with Joseph Atwill in the second hour and go deeper into the analysis of the book and discuss the genocide that is mentioned cryptically in the book, and we get Joseph's take on that. Atwill gives us much more to think about when it comes to how the book came about, how it connects with the intelligence agencies, the overall plan to subvert culture and begin to move us away from how things used to be, like lemmings screaming for change and progress while heading over the cliff. We extend the conversation into sex, drugs, and rock and roll and talk about the Beatles and the seemingly nonsensical song I'm the Walrus by John Lennon. So, you know, skip the movies, stop supporting those who want to subvert you and propagandize you, and instead start supporting independent media. So please join us for much more at redicemembers.com. Go there to sign up and, of course, enjoy our archives. You get instant access. It's only €5 per month. You can sign up for a 3-month subscription, recurring or non-recurring, and try it out. We have all the details on the website. By the way, our next program is with Marion Van Court on eugenics versus dysgenics. But we'll proceed right now, ladies and gentlemen, with Joseph Atwill.